Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam asher bachar banu mikol hamim v'natan lanu et torato baruch ata Adonai notein haTorah.
It's struggling.
Hang in there. Yes, you can do it. Okay.
Here we go.
Yay. All right. The flame wins out. Hooray. Like, how do fires get started? Seriously, when you, like, light a candle and it goes, my Shabbos candles went out. One of them went out. But I'm like, nothing happened. There's no wind. There's no air conditioning. Nothing. Just went out. It's like, how'd that happen? It looks so sad on Shabbos, too, to have, like, a blown out Shabbos candle. Okay, good morning. We are on the Parsha Vayakhel, which is on page, say again?
517.
Page 507, thank you. 517, sorry, 517. Page 517 is the Parsha Vayakhel. And the Parsha Vayakhel is the concluding Parsha of all the Parshas that we have had so far that have focused on the building of the Mishkan. And now, like, one more time, now the people are going to all bring the contributions. All of the description, all of the ideas have been given and the directions for how they're supposed to build the Mishkan, but now it's going to be actually built and all the contributions are going to be coming in. So the first thing we want to talk about, and that's actually the main focus, is we're going to talk about the contributions for the Mishkan, who brought them and what the motivation was. And we're going to learn about that for ourselves of what we can appreciate for our own lives. So if you want to take a look at page 517, chapter 35, verse 10. And so let's take a look at that here. And Peggy, would you like to start for us this morning?
How much do you want me to just
take? Verse 10.
Okay. Every wise-hearted person among you shall come and make everything that the Shem has commanded.
Okay, so we want to look at that. So who is supposed to come? In the Hebrew, it's called a chacham lev. A wise-hearted person, someone who has a wise heart. So the question is, what does that mean and who is that? We're actually going to go back for a moment to chapter 31. So if you want to keep your string here and go back to chapter 31, which is in Kitisa, Parsha Kitisa, and we want to look at the beginning of it on page 489. And we're going to read that the description of the calling of Bezalel and Oholiab and what their qualifications were. Peggy, would you just like to continue with chapter 31, verses 1 through 4?
Hashem spoke to Moses, saying, "See, I have called by the name Bezalel, son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. I have filled him with a godly spirit, with wisdom, insight, and knowledge, and with every craft, to weave designs, to work with gold, silver, and copper."
And stone cutting.
Stone cutting, presetting, and wood carving, to perform every craft.
Okay. So this selection of Bezalel to lead the building of the Mishkan, it's really kind of interesting. There's a whole understanding about why he is the one who is called. It says when he was called, he was only 13 years old. And it says that Hashem called him. It says, Re'eh karati v'shem, I, God, have called in name Bezalel ben Uri, the son of Hur of the tribe of Yehuda. And God says, and I have filled him with a godly spirit. So here's this 13-year-old person who comes out of Egypt just recently. He certainly wasn't anybody who knew anything about any of the crafts or craftsmanship of anything. And even today, think about it. If you saw somebody and somebody gave you their business card and their resume, and they said, yes, I know how to work with every craft. I can weave, I can do gold, I can do silver, I can do copper, I can do stone cutting, I can do wood carving, I can do it all. What would your perspective be about that?
I would think he was a good contractor.
I was going to say, yeah, subcontractors, like that. What does that mean? That's not possible. So even today, it's not possible. So even more so at the time of the building of the Mishkan, not possible for anybody to have that because they just came out of slavery. There wasn't the Bezalel School of Art and knowing how to do all these things.
Beth Ann. Is he considered a prophet?
Not a prophet. He wasn't considered a prophet. It says that God filled him with that knowledge to be able to do it. And why did he do that? Is it because he was a wise-hearted person? Bezalel was a wise-hearted person. He also was the grandson that we see because he's listed in a very unusual way. He was the son of Uri, and usually that's how people are named by who their father is. But it also tells us who Uri was, the son of Hur. Who was Hur? It says Hur was killed. He was killed by the Jewish people at the building of the golden calf, and because he objected and tried to stop them, and so they killed him. And he gave his life, l'shem shemayim, for the sake of heaven. And this is really a reward for Bezalel, a reward to Hur coming down through the generations. So one of the ideas that we'll come back to is that when we do something, when we do the right thing, even if, God forbid, we die in the process, it doesn't mean like, well, there, that person is now gone and everything good that they did is now gone. It says God saves up every single good thing, and that Hur is rewarded and gets to have nachas from heaven, and that he can actually enjoy to have his grandson be the one who is endowed with the spirit to be able to handle and do and manage all of these crafts. It also says something about Bezalel. How would you feel if you were Bezalel, where the Jewish people killed your grandfather? I'm not sure you would necessarily be looking to take on a leadership role, number one, because that's not maybe such a good idea. And also, you could have a lot of pent-up anger toward the people. Why should you work with all these people who killed your grandfather? So it also expresses that Hur forgave, had a spirit of forgiveness towards the Jewish people, as did God, of forgiveness for them having killed Hur in moments of passion, that it wasn't considered a premeditated murder. And so having Bezalel be the one to head up this project, that he's the perfect one for lots of different reasons. And what he brings to it is his own passion, his own commitment, and his own wise-heartedness. So if he was a wise-hearted person, but clearly a wise-hearted person doesn't mean that you're wise to start, meaning that he didn't have all the talents to start. God gave them to him. So the question is, why did God give him all these abilities he didn't have? So from this, we are learning about what God does for all of us in all of our spiritual endeavors. So let's go on and go back to the parsha where we are, back to where your string is, and we also are going to talk about other wise-hearted people. And let's see, hold on 1 second, chapter 36. Okay. Let's go to chapter 36, actually on page 521. Chapter 36, verse 1, and let's read that. Okay, Bernice, would you like to read that?
This well shall carry out with
Oholiab,
and every wise-hearted man within whom Hashem has endowed wisdom and insight to know, and to do all the work for the labor of the sanctuary, everything that Hashem has commanded.
Okay, and why didn't you, and verse 2, Elena, do you want to continue?
Moses summoned Bezalel of Holiab and every wise-hearted man whose heart Hashem endowed with wisdom. Everyone whose heart inspired him to approach the work to do it.
Okay. So the word that keeps being repeated over and over is wise-heartedness. So we usually associate the word of a chacham, a wise person, as somebody. How would you define a wise person?
Learned in Torah.
Somebody who's learned in Torah. Someone who knows a lot. It's used in the critical way, like when someone says it sarcastically and says, oh, they're such a chacham. What does that mean? Know it all, or they're stupid, you know, they're such a chacham, they did this, you know, something stupid. So it's used like to be the reverse as well. But we associate the chacham, as being somebody who is wise and knows a lot. So we're going to come, not to scare anybody, but Pesach is coming soon. And we have in the Haggadah, in the Seder, we have a reference to a wise child. We have the Chacham Mahu Omer. So we have the wise child asks, and what does he ask? He asks, what is the meaning of the laws, statutes, and customs which the Lord our God has commanded us? And you shall explain to him all the laws of Passover to the very last detail about the Afikoman. What's a little surprising about these questions if it's coming from the Chacham?
Very simplistic.
It's simplistic, and if you assume, like the Chacham,
he should already know.
Who doesn't know? You don't know what matzah is about? You don't know the law of matzah? You don't know the law of maror? It's like, I wouldn't call you a Chacham. I would say maybe you're curious or something, but you wouldn't say it's a Chacham. So this means we need to really revamp our understanding of what God considers a Chacham and what we consider a Chacham. A Chacham is not someone who knows the information. A Chacham is someone who values Chachma, someone who values wisdom, who is passionate about gaining wisdom and wants to know and wants to excel. It is about the desire, not what you already have learned. In fact, what has already been learned is that's nice and that's good, but it has no comparison to wanting to learn. In fact, sometimes it's a disadvantage for someone who knows a lot. They sometimes can. Is anyone else warm now?
No.
Yes.
Okay. Bonnie, thank you. That somebody who knows a lot can kind of rest on their laurels and say, oh, I've learned a lot. You know, you should see all the tzedakah I gave last week. I'm like a real, you know, I'm a real tzaddik here, and I learned this, and I know this, I know that. It's like, that is not a chacham. A chacham is not a master of information. A chacham is somebody who is passionate about wanting wisdom, who wants to excel, who wants to grow. So the story about a rabbi who's visiting the Mir Yeshiva in Europe, and he says to the head of the yeshiva, show me your best yeshiva bacher, show me the best one. And he points to this one, he says, this one is the best in Gemara, this one is the best in, you know, all these different things. And he says, but that one over there in the corner, that one, he's the best bacher. And he said, the best yeshiva boy. He says, why, what makes him the best? How come this one isn't the best, the one who's mastered all of this material? He says, he wants it the most. He wants it the most. And now, this is not good because I forgot the punchline of that person turned in to be like a Rosh Yeshiva, like the head, of the one of the great men of the generation, because he wanted it. And it's interesting that we're told that each of us is supposed to ask ourselves on a daily basis, when will I reach a level that will be the same as our matriarchs and patriarchs? When will I reach a level of an Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and a Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah? When will I achieve that? That's my goal, is to achieve that. It says, if we don't shoot for the moon, shoot for the stars, first of all, we won't achieve really anything, and that is supposed to be our aspiration, whether we make it or not. It's having the aspiration, that's called a chacham lev. That's called a chacham, that's called somebody who is aspiring, wants to grow. And that we're supposed to want that level for ourselves in every category. When will my chesed reach the level of Avraham? When will my yirat shamayim, my awe of heaven, reach that of Yitzchak? When will my level reach in every single quality, each of my midos? When will I be as refined as Jacob, as refined as Esther, as refined as Ruth? All of these people, those are our role models. And it's not just like, oh yeah, we'll read about them. I remember I used to love to read biographies. You know, the beginning of, I don't know, whatever it was. That's what I used to just soak up. And all those people say, oh, that's so inspiring, that's so interesting. But I can't say that I ever said, now that's who I am going to be. I would say, oh, you know, I learned about dedication, I learned about interest, I learned about medicine, I learned about whatever it was, adventure, I learned about courage, but not like I am going to be that person. That transfer of identity, of this is my aspiration, this is who I am going to be, that is called a chacham. That's the person who is passionate about it, who desires it. And that when that happens, says, God will give us those qualities. Now, it doesn't necessarily work in the physical world because we have more limitations. The spiritual world is No limitations. Nobody has any limitations. We assume that just because you took your whatever test, I remember when I took the SATs or whatever, my math score, I don't think it officially came with a comment of don't pursue a career in math, but it was close to that. They happen to be in wrong, as a matter of fact, because I majored and have a master's in economics, and my math is just fine. It just wasn't good on tests. So, but be that as it may, there are limitations that we have in other realms, but spiritually we don't have limitations. The only limitation we have is our own self-limitation, our own perception of what we have. And that being said, it's also true in the physical realm. It says a person playing baseball, yes, you have to get to first base first, but if your intention is not to make a home run, you're not going to get to first base either. So it says your intention when you play is to make a run. Susan?
Athletes always say that they visualize themselves.
Visualize themselves succeeding all the way to the top. We don't necessarily have an image of ourselves. So we just accept, like, maybe a slightly improved version, you know, like instead of what's my aspiration. So it's true. It's one base at a time, and I'm not a sports person, but the sports metaphors work really well, especially mm-hmm. with the Olympics going on. Are they still going on? Okay, all right. So out of it. All these are going on. Okay, so all these things going on that, you know, that the touchdown is made 1 yard at a time. But if you're not seeing yourself at the goal line, you're not going anywhere. So it says we need to do the same thing. We need to take the lesson from the sports heroes. Some people think, well, wouldn't that be depressing? You set your sights so high and then you don't get there. In the physical realm, that may happen. In the spiritual realm, it won't. Susan?
No, I didn't.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So that's our goal, and that was what was the greatness of the Jewish people at the time of the building of the Mishkan, is they were all chachmat lev. They were all desiring, like, it wasn't just, I have some gold. Their vision was, I'm building the Mishkan for the dwelling of the Shekhinah, of the Divine Presence. And that fired them. That creates a passion and an energy and an enthusiasm and a focus that helps somebody direct their efforts and energies. If you just think, my goal is to read the next page. That may be the next step, but it can't be the goal. My goal is to do the whole thing. I used to not like this when they had goals and objectives, like when you have to write that at business, like, what's your goal, what are your objectives, what are your steps, your action steps. But if the goal is not super high, it's not going to be what we're looking for. Susan?
So isn't it just kind of a quick turnaround? We just talked about the golden calf, and now it just seems so, like, it just flip-flopped so quickly.
How did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, their goal seems so lofty now. And we just talked about how they fell so low.
It's a great question. It says that Moshe, even though the command to build the Mishkan came from God, says that Moshe, this was actually from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, talked about leadership, and a team that builds together will be successful. Is Moshe basically involved everyone in the project to harness their spiritual energy in a productive way. And that when they went down, the negative energy, and that's true about anything and anything about ourselves, that whenever we are doing something really, really wrong, in a way, it's not that it's good, it just means there's a lot of energy that just needs to be redirected and refocused. So there are some who say that God gave the command to build the Mishkan in seeing that the people had such passion, which they took in the wrong direction, and to put it in the right direction. Same thing is true with kids. The kid who is causing the most trouble and is getting everyone else off track is a leader. And if you can get them turned around, the child who's really the problem is the one who's apathetic. Okay, so apathy is the enemy to spiritual greatness. The great passion can be really good, or it can be very destructive. So the building of the Mishkan takes all of the Jewish people's spiritual energy and directs it in the right place, and then we see how great the Jewish people are and what they're doing. So it's a really good question. Kay.
So obviously there was a difference of gold. I mean, the gold that was used for the golden calf, it came from people?
The men.
And then the gold that went into the building of the Mishkan came from?
The women.
That's the difference.
Okay, so the women, it says, and the women, the men came, and it says that the men came after the women. See, I didn't notice that, so I'm not sure exactly where it is.
It's on page 519, it says the men came with the women.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. So right beforehand, the men came with the women. It doesn't really say that in the Hebrew, where it says in verse 22, it says, Vayavo ha'anashim al hanashim. And the men came on the women, and it means on the women's footsteps, on their heels.
Okay,
that they came after the women. This makes it sound either like they came together or the women like were the tag-alongs. Like the women weren't the tag-alongs. The women came first, and the anashim were al hanashim, on the women's footsteps. They came on their heels, and the women were the ones who were super motivated to do everything. And they inspired the rest of the Jewish people as well.
Was this a form of teshuva?
Yes, this exactly, because teshuva is where you have an opportunity to do something and you do the opposite. So you take the very same materials.
You found them. I just wanted to make sure.
Thank you. Where you take the very same thing and you redirect it and you correct it. So building the Mishkan is a tremendous teshuva for the Jewish people. So that's the other thing, is when we've done something wrong, and this also goes into what Susan was asking, and they knew that once it becomes clear, it's not like they didn't know that building the golden calf was wrong, but once it became crystal clear that it was wrong, a person who wants to grow, it's like they want to, as soon as possible, fix it. How can I correct what I have done? How can I, if only I had a chance to do that over again. Just like kids say, can I have a do-over? Can I do it again? Can I try again? Can I have another chance? It's like, give us another chance and we'll show you what we're really made of. And then that's why the Jewish people have all that energy. So it's teshuva energy. It's love of God energy. It is the desire to redirect and to do the right thing. Susan.
That idea with the idea of we're also though expected to take small steps.
Ah, small steps.
In the action area, it's one step at a time, but
yes.
In the goal area, it's
right.
Much bigger.
Exactly. So is it think globally, act locally? Think big, act small. Because you could completely overwhelm and depress yourself by having only a lofty goal with no way to get there. So it must be done step by step, but if the goal is not kept in our mind and we don't choose that. So this was really interesting. There's a Gemara that says the most important mitzvah is bechira, which means free choice. We don't usually think of free choice as a mitzvah. You usually have it as, okay, I'm exercising my free choice that I have on doing the right thing or doing the wrong thing. But I don't tend to think of bechira, of choice, as a mitzvah in and of itself. It says it's so important, it's a prerequisite for all of the other mitzvahs. Because if we don't choose ourselves, and that's what we have control over, I can choose what my goal is. God is not making me choose my goal. That's where I exercise my free will of what's my goal. And, this is even more beautiful, is by simply having the goal of I aspire to this great height, says we are rewarded as if we achieved it. As long as it goes along with taking the small steps. So my goal could be here, this is my goal, and I'm taking my little steps day by day, and I may only get to here. My heavenly reward is for this, because that's what I was shooting for. So it's a win-win situation. Okay? It's a win-win to shoot as high as possible and to aim for the stars of tremendous greatness in every single aspect of our service of God. It says most people spend most of their energy aspiring for greatness in realms where they don't have as much control and where they may or not be successful. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to do other things and use our gifts and our talents. But in the service of God and fulfilling as many mitzvahs, refining our personalities, our characters, everything that we can do, says we are rewarded for the goal we set for ourselves. Usually, I remember doing like work performance plans, like at work, you didn't want to set too high of a goal for the coming year because your evaluation was based on how you did on that. It's like, so why would you set it high? Set it like, I'll do this much better, and then surprise, I made it. Okay, so that's how we usually tend to do it. Like, I'll just do something modest because I don't want to be disappointed and I don't want to be graded low. So we have kind of an educational model. Instead, can you imagine if teachers graded students on, like, I want to be the next Albert Schweitzer? And they're like, you know, did you see your grade last quarter? I don't think it's happening. So, I mean, that's what we're used to. That's how we're used to evaluating ourselves and setting goals for ourselves. Instead of saying, I will be the next, I am Sarah. I am Rachel. I am Leah. I am, it's like, read the books. There's wonderful biographies out about more recent people than our matriarchs and patriarchs who help us see, like, holy women, or there's all just great stories about great. There's a book out about Rebbetzin Kanievsky, who recently passed away, and her greatness and her chesed. I'm like, this woman did not have the same 24 hours in the day that I have. Not possible. It isn't possible. It's like you're just reading it. It's like, no, this is really true. How is that possible? So setting our sights as high as possible, and we are rewarded for it as if we achieved it, and then we take our steps step by step.
Okay, so I'm still obsessing about the whole golden calf.
Okay.
So we talk about the Jewish people building the Mishkan.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talk about ourselves, we talk about the Jewish people. Collectively, we're intertwined. You've spoken about that many times. But in truth, the women didn't sin.
They didn't. That's true. So you're saying, so was it a teshuvah for them? Mm-hmm. They were keeping their goal to build the Mishkan for the future. Because there was an idea that there was going to be. So there's actually a question. Did the commandment for the building of the Mishkan come before or after the sin of the golden calf? So there's actually two opinions. So they were going to be building a Mishkan anyway. And the women were saying, when they didn't give it for the golden calf, it's like, this only goes for something for God, not for a golden calf. So they, for them, it wasn't teshuva. For them, it was an expression of their desire to begin with.
Okay.
For the men, it would have been teshuva. The truth is, the Levites didn't sin either.
Right.
So for them, they also, it was not teshuva for them. So, but there is also a teshuva on leadership, which is that if we remember that what God said to Moshe when Moshe's still up on Mount Sinai, and God tells Moshe, your people, your children, are sinning down there. Let me destroy everybody. God was going to destroy everybody except for Moshe. And I guess some woman, because he was going to make a nation out of him. So it was going to be eliminate everybody, including people who, quote, officially didn't sin. Because what's the sin of the leadership? Is how is it that the women and the Levi'im together were not able to influence the rest of the Jewish people not to do what they did? How does it they end up killing Hur? That's not good. So a leadership, so there's a difference between I didn't sin and a little bit like Noah. You know, Noah was called an Ish Tzaddik because he didn't sin, but he's criticized because he was not able to persuade anybody else to give up their sin either. So there is some teshuva to be done.
Okay.
At that level. But that's a really good question. Okay, so you can obsess some more, so think of what else you'd like to talk about. Naomi.
Isn't there a story when Korach does his rebellion and one of the people that was going to be part of the rebellion, his wife was going, you're not going.
Yeah, you're not going. Yeah. And she basically got him, like, I don't know, like drunk or something, so he slept, and then she sat outside the tent with her hair undone, and these rebellious people, even though they were ready to rebel against Moshe, would not go next to a woman who was like, her hair all undone and like not dressed appropriately. They're like too religious for that, but not too religious for this. Okay, a little mixed, confused. Okay, but yes, and she saves him. She saves her husband. So it says the women are supposed to figure out how to do this, save our husbands. And it's not, no one's saying it's easy, and no one's saying that they didn't try. We don't know what they tried. Who knows? I mean, they certainly did not give of themselves. And they're like, I'm not doing this. And I'm sure they said, and you shouldn't be either. But, you know, when people are beyond help, that sometimes you can't control. We can't control other people. We can only suggest, advise, be a good role model. And so in the end, that's what we're able to do. Okay. So all of this wise-heartedness. So we have these, again, the benefits of being wise-hearted, of wanting it. So that gives us the setting the goal high and like to the stars and really figuring out, and not just, I want to be great, but to pick a person, to pick one of the matriarchs or the patriarchs, one of the great people, is pick someone who becomes then a role model to learn about and then to aspire to that. And it could be somebody who was recently alive or whatever, somebody to aspire to who's really high and appears to have, and this is the clincher, appears to have qualities that we don't yet have. So that it is exactly like Bezalel, that we're not supposed to say, take what you have and see how far you can go with it. It's saying aspire to reach a level where you don't even have those abilities. just like Bezalel. He didn't have, not one of those abilities did he have, not one, nor did any of the other Jewish people. So they were building storehouses. They were building, you know, with bricks. There wasn't anything that was weaving, and then I get a little, you know, the cherubs in there, and then I'm hammering gold, and I'm doing the menorah. And I'm doing. There was none of that for anybody. It says God gave them all the wisdom that they needed because they were chachmat leib. Is anyone now cold?
Yes.
Yes. Ronnie, thank you for monitoring. Our two temperatures, hot, cold, hot, cold.
Okay.
Those are the choices in some of these older buildings, hot and cold. Okay, so this idea is that when we want it, then we will be given the qualities that we need, and then we enter into a whole dynamic that helps bring us ourselves to a level that is beyond what we ever would have thought possible, and that we are rewarded for having the goals. What we also contribute to that then is having the goal. And seeing where we are now gives us focus, enthusiasm, alacrity, because then we see that we're really working towards something. If the people, again going to the sports metaphor, if I think, oh, I only have a yard. In fact, as a spectator, you think, how hard could it really be to carry the ball a yard? It's like, you know, I can almost reach it with one foot, you know, with one leg here. I can go a yard. So you think, how hard is it to do that? It's like, ah. Well, just like in the game where there will be opposing forces that are going to keep you, and there's going to be the other team in the defensive play that's going to be trying to keep you from getting there, so you better have a strategy. It's not that you're just on the field by yourself and you're going to go run 100 yards or 50 yards to get to the goal. You're not. There's going to be opposing force. And the quality of the play is evaluated based on how well we encounter the opposing force. So the truth is there are going to be two things that are going to go on. God is going to help us, and there's going to be an opposing force to increase our merit for having made the choice to enter into the goal and enter into striving for the goal. You could say, well, if you really want me to achieve it, why don't you just clear away all the obstacles? It's like, well, if you really want to make the goal, why don't you just take the other team off the field? It's like, that's not the game. That's not how it works. So it's going to invite obstacles. And at the same time, it will invite the help, the divine help, and the divine help will be greater than the obstacles. It's like having a great coach. You can have the help in addition to the obstacles, because we have to have the merit for our achievement as well. And you think about Bezalel, as he had to overcome. He had to overcome the obstacle of, here, I'm doing this for the Jewish people who killed my grandfather. That's something to overcome. I have to overcome the charges of nepotism that everyone started hurling at Moshe. It's like, oh, isn't this interesting? You picked your nephew to head up this project after picking your brother to be the Kohen Gadol. Isn't that interesting? So he had to overcome all that, and he was 13 years old. So imagine there's some other people who think, you're going to put that kid in charge of a project? So those are all emotional and spiritual obstacles for someone to face. It wasn't just like that it was easy street for him. He had to also overcome challenges in order to emerge. And then he's put with Oholiab. Bezalel is from the tribe of Yehuda, which are the leaders of the Jewish people. Oholiab is from the tribe of Dan, which is considered, if you could say, like, not the lowest, but kind of like, you know, not as lofty as Yehuda. So it could also be, I don't know, just projecting, saying, why do I have to do it with him? Like, maybe I feel now like really great. God gave me all this talent. I'll do it all myself. Instead of like, why do I have to do it with him? So we can only imagine the different qualities, the different challenges, the different obstacles that came up in this whole process. So that's what is a chacham leiv, and that's our child who is the wise son at the Seder. When he's asking those questions, it's clear he doesn't know the answer, because asking questions you know the answer to is not so smart. So asking questions, he doesn't have the answers. So you'd say, you're not so smart. It's like, ah, you are smart, because that's a great question. It shows you want to know. So there was, I don't know if it was Rabbi Dr. Chorsky, or maybe, no, it may have been some other rabbi, who said that when he used to come home from school, that his mother did not ask him, what did you learn today? He said, what questions did you ask? I'll know more about you by what questions you ask than by what you, quote, already know. And yesterday's accomplishment, while we should feel good about it, says we should consider it as if it doesn't exist. We're starting over every single day. So it shows the parallel that in the Mishkan and in the Beit HaMikdash, every morning, the very first order of business, the very, very first order of business was the removal of the ashes from yesterday's sacrifice. So on one hand, you could say, well, sure, they had to clean everything up. But they had to get rid of every single evidence that there had been a sacrifice yesterday. Because why? Today is a new day. Just like my 1960s poster, today is the first day of the rest of your life. So while we should be inspired by our accomplishments, if they lead us to oh, you should have seen the sacrifice I made yesterday. It was so good. You should see what I learned yesterday, what I did yesterday. It's like, mazel tov, let's start today. And what about today? So it's also is supposed to help motivate us so that we don't become complacent and just sit back and say, I did a lot already today, yesterday, and this earlier in this week. It's like, that sacrifice is over. Now, what's for today? Beth Ann.
So how does one judge one's progress or lack thereof?
In a spiritual sense?
Right.
So sometimes it's also not clear. This is me saying this. I'm thinking that if your goal is high and you have an attitude of, I have an obligation and I'm excited about taking new steps every single day, small steps. We're not ever told to take giant steps. Small steps every day is guaranteed success. So you can always, and then you do a cheshbon ha-nefesh. So that we do at the end of the day. So in bed, that's part of what we're supposed to do, is review the day. What opportunities did I take? Because we're not supposed to just go blindly on and be oblivious to what we're doing, but we're supposed to put it in a context. Say, was there a situation? Did I handle this right? I had some extra time. Did I sit there and just, twiddle my thumbs or do something to, quote, kill time? Did I use my time wisely? Is there a pocket of opportunity that I missed? How did I do? Did I handle this well? We have to be realistic and honest about what we achieve as well as what we didn't achieve. And then that we can set a goal for tomorrow. I know tomorrow the same scenario is going to probably unfold again. How will I handle it differently? And so that's how we take step by step. And keeping in mind, I'm trying to be like Avraham, I'm trying to be like Sarah, so what's the next best step to take me in that direction? So the end of the day is when we evaluate how we're doing. Cheshbon ha-nefesh, which means an accounting of your soul.
So how does this translate into our modern life?
So tell me more what your question is, of what you mean.
Suppose we are in the program, we want to do this.
Uh-huh.
So how do we look at our normal day? How do we aspire to something?
How we do that? Okay, so that's a really good question. So there's going to be different aspects of it. So first of all, it's having the plan of the aspiration, picking a person, picking a quality to work on that you want to become the greatest in. And it can be a personal midah, it can be in patience, it can be in acts of chesed, it can be in tzedakah, it can be in patience, it can be in any quality, it can be in learning Torah, it can be in davening, it can be in tehillim, it can be in visiting the sick, it can be anything you want to pick something to focus on, and to then have a role model of what it's going to look like, and then to learn about how to do it well. There are sfarim, there are readings, there are Google things you can find on every single thing that you could possibly want to do. Not gossiping, there's the laws of Shmiras HaLashon, guarding your tongue. And life, as it unfolds, calls upon us always to exercise every single one of those qualities. It doesn't matter what time period we live in. There'll be opportunities for developing patience. God will be sure to put people in your life. It says, I want to develop patience, but just don't give me any annoying people. You'll get your job. Whatever it is you want, you will get exactly. Thank you very much. Okay. So you'll get it. Torah is for our lives. Every single thing that you would want. If you decide to work on, you want to be the Chofetz Chaim. I'm going to be like the Chofetz Chaim. I'm going to be the Chofetz Chaim. The Chofetz Chaya. I'm going to be the female version of her.
Aren't most of us doing this anyway?
I'd say on small levels with not the extreme high aspirations. We think we want to be a better. Most of us say, well, I could be doing better.
Yeah.
But better is not good enough. We want to say, I want to be the best at it. I want to master this. I want to be tops in that. Not just better tomorrow than I was today, and not just better than a lot of other people I know, because that's another thing. It's like, well, I'm doing better than other people I know. That's a real, that's called the kiss of death of spiritual growth is, yeah, I'm doing better than other people I know. Okay, that's not good. Or I'm pretty good, and I'll keep trying a little bit more. The aspiration is what we're supposed to have. That's actually, it's not even a suggestion. It is a commandment. We are chayev. We are obligated to say to ourselves each day, when will my deeds match the level of the matriarchs and patriarchs and the other great people? That's a different thing. That's again like saying it's to someone who is in the, you know, little league, when will I be, and usually you'd say, you're a kid, what are you aspiring for that? Just try to be the top of who's in your league. We tend to see ourselves as being in a certain league and judge ourselves accordingly. Saying we need to want to be in the big league and work up toward it. So that's the difference. And we're actually obligated to do that. And making that choice is what makes us a chacham. It makes us a chachmat lev of a wise-hearted person. So we just pick a character because you can't work on everything all the time because that's too hard. It's to just pick something, to pick something to work on in any of those categories. And the truth is one thing leads to another. A person who is working on not gossiping has to change the way they see other people, because it's not enough to walk around just with your mouth closed. It's because we speak according to the way we think. So if we think about people differently, we speak about them differently, which opens my heart to also then be more, have a chesed approach and a little more loving approach, which will probably also lead me to be more patient with them because I have some compassion for them. So one thing kind of leads to another anyway. So to pick something. And if you're saying Tehillim or you're praying for people, when you start praying for somebody's health and recovery, you start to care about them. And when you care about them, you're interested in them, and then you call them. And if you call them, then you find out what they need, and you do something for them. So it's all like 613 windows, doors into the same room. It will all get us there. And that's our goal. So that's a good question. It's like, how do we do that? That's what we do. And we launch ourselves into this next life. Thank you. That's what we're supposed to do. And I am talking to myself here. I'm like, that is a really good idea. Okay. So one other piece I want to talk about, which is in our last segment here, is people always laugh over this section, but we want to look at the place where the Jewish people brought so much that Moshe had to tell them to stop. Every fundraiser's dream come true. Page 521. Like, they should really have a fundraiser and say, we're going to see if we can reenact this parsha. We're going to reenact chapter 36, verse 4. Okay? Verses 4 and 5. Actually, we're going to do verses 4 through 7 all together. Eileen, would you like to read that for us, please?
Sure. All the wise people came, those performing all the sacred work, each of them from his work that they were doing. And they said to Moses as follows, the people are bringing more than enough for the labor of the work that Hashem has commanded to perform. Moses commanded that they proclaim throughout the camp, saying, man and woman shall not do more work toward the gift for the sanctuary. And the people were restrained from bringing, but the work had been enough for all the work to do it, and there was extra.
It's just really amazing.
This is a lofty goal.
It is. This is a miracle. The whole world would be completely transformed. If these four verses came true, our world would look completely different. Okay, so the people came because they were the wise people, the people who wanted, everybody wanted it. And again, we've talked about that this kind of chachmat lev brings enthusiasm, alacrity, an openness, a giving, a generosity. It opens up all the greatest qualities that we want. And that's the other piece to really keep in mind. Someone says, I really need to work on alacrity. And they're like sitting there like, I really need to work on alacrity. It's like, you can't work on alacrity if you're not motivated towards the goal. Otherwise, doing it faster, it's not going to happen, and there's going to be a schlep factor involved. Okay, so the people are coming, performing all the sacred work, And they said to Moses, the people are bringing more than enough for the labor of the work that Hashem has commanded. And so he tells them, stop. And the people were restrained from bringing. Okay, he's like, stop bringing. Just imagine, Jewish experience. No more checks. We have enough. We're done. Aish, the shul, BMH, anything. But the work had been enough for all the work to do it, and there was extra. So we're actually going to focus on the question, on all of these issues. But the work had been enough for all the work to do it. There was enough to do it, and there was extra. So the question is, was there enough or was there extra? Eileen.
But maybe they brought so much because they felt so guilty. Does that change anything?
Interesting that you say that. That's one commentary that I did not see. That they felt guilty, that this was not coming from a place of guilt, it was all coming from love. It was coming from this chachmat lev and this nidiva of this generosity. You know if somebody's giving you something because they feel guilty and you feel like you're kind of like being bought off, here, I did something, so you know, here's some, what do they say, whatever, a man makes a mistake, here's some flowers and candy and like, do you forgive me? And here's a necklace too. It's like, it's not that you wouldn't love those things, but you can tell if you're being bought off or if it's like, I love you so much, I want to give you those things. Mm-hmm. This was coming from love. So that's a good question, because it could have been like guilt, it could have named it a guilt offering, but it wasn't a guilt offering, it was a love offering. Linda.
One thing that I had read on the partial of the golden calf was that Moses broke the tablets because that was out of his love for the Jewish people, because they couldn't disobey what they didn't already know. And now they know. They have the tablets. They have it from God at this point. Before the golden, or at the time of the golden calf, they didn't have it from God.
But they'd been given it verbally.
But they'd been given actually verbally. So it's like they were, so the difference is that they were betrothed, but not married, kind of. You can understand it that way. They didn't have the ketubah, which is the contract.
So now they have the contract.
Now they have the contract, and now they know. But they knew before. Otherwise, you can't punish people for a sin they didn't know. And they were punished, the people who participated in the golden calf, each according to the way they were punished. So I had also read that, that he did throw it down as a sign of out of love for them. There's also a thing that said that the letters flew off of the tablets and they became so heavy they dropped out of his hands. He could no longer carry them because he was able to carry them like they show in the movie with one arm, so until they get so heavy. So yeah, there's also some interesting commentary on that. Okay, let's see what happens here about having more than they needed and also about the act of stopping. So when it says that the people were restrained from bringing, this is an interesting idea, and this was from a commentary called the Shemen HaTov, and it says that sometimes people give just to be on the bandwagon. They're kind of swept up in the excitement and the energy, and they don't necessarily, they're not necessarily so wholehearted, but everyone's doing it, so we're doing it too. And they just kind of get going. So that was kind of an interesting idea to have floating around, is like, what were the true motivations of the people? When Moshe tells them to stop, says it's interesting that all qualities that we have their appropriate time and their appropriate place. A person who is master over their emotions and master over their actions is a person who has self-control that you can really judge what they're doing or whether they just got totally carried away. So if you think about all the things that eating is great, being able to stop eating at an appropriate time, now that's exercising restraint, that's something. Talking is good, knowing when to be quiet is even better. Everything that's like actions about doing something, giving, 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 same thing you could say with parents to children. Giving, 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 knowing when to stop and how much is enough is a master, as it says, who is strong, a person who has mastery over themselves. So the act of restraining is, we're Moshe showing the Jewish people, it's great that you want to give, that's wonderful. Do you also know when to stop? It's like when enough is enough. That's a quality. So it's just like to understand that from a spiritual growth place, is everything has its time. You know, davening is great. Spending all day davening, not supposed to do that. Work is great. Working all day without 24/7, not so good. That everything has its limit, and being able to exercise those limits is a part of our spiritual growth of having a time for everything. In fact, we can use it. Human nature is to keep on going. What is one of the laws of thermodynamics or something, that unless you act upon something, it just keeps on going? So you can use that to the benefit. If you have trouble getting going with something, it's just start, and the momentum kind of takes you. But then you're not really acting with free will there. You're just going based on your going. And that this idea of being able to halt one's giving, it was an appropriate quality as well. So that was just as an aside. The other idea that I thought was interesting, when it talks about that they had more than enough, is that, and there was extra, that the giving of all the materials for the Mishkan, it says, was needed because they were building the Mishkan. But the truth is that there's a beautiful midrash that says all of the gems that were used for the Choshen Mishpat, for the breastplate, it says God had that rained down with the manna and was given to the people to then build the Mishkan with. It's like, well, if God was going to rain down the gems, like, while you're at it, why don't you just rain down everything else too? Why was it that the Jewish people had to give? And in fact, we also know, it says that the third temple, the Beit HaMikdash, is going to descend from heaven. We're not going to even build it. It's going to come down, that there's some people who are religiously, spiritually sensitive, who look out every morning on the Har HaBayit in Israel and see if the Beit HaMikdash is there yet. It's like, so, is it there yet? It's like, and it's not like, oh, well, we didn't build it yet. It's like, well, we're not going to be building it anyway. It's going to just come down. So whatever that means, that's a whole other class, a whole other topic. So the idea, though, is if God, who created the whole world, could have created the Mishkan, and the Jewish people could have woken up one morning, and there would have been a Mishkan. And it wasn't even that, you know, it wasn't as elaborate as the temple, so it wasn't even like that fancy or that hard for God to do. So why is it that God had us do it? So it goes back a little bit to the idea of the golden calf and the idea of what the Jewish people were doing. It says the Mishkan was really built more than out of all the precious materials. It was built from the hearts of the Jewish people. And that was what they gave. And that's what was determined of that they had to give enough, because you have this paradoxical statement here, but the work had been enough for all the work to do it, and there was extra. So there's extra what? So there was this extra giving of, I want to give. That's what was required for the building of the Mishkan, more than the materials. The materials, there was extra. The wanting to give, there was just what was needed for the building of the Mishkan, which was this huge desire. It resulted in extra physical materials, but it was given, it was the giving that is what really built the Mishkan. And that God used then, so it says that even though there was more built, there were more materials donated than what were needed for the very precise measurements. Be like if you were making a cake and everyone came and brought their ingredients and the cake calls for 4 cups of flour, but instead there's 10 cups of flour, but you're still only having one cake and it has to be a certain dimensions. That's okay, bring me your flour, I'll just put it in anyway. Normally it would wreck it up. So this understanding says that God arranged for all of the donations, all of the material donations to be used, even if it was too much. It wasn't like they said, oh, well, we'll just put it in the closet and we'll use it later. Sorry, your donation, that was extra, so, you know, we'll save it for when we need some repairs. That it wasn't. It all went in. And that this message was so important for us to know, that even if somebody brought a small amount, but they brought it with a heart full of love, that it was used. And that the same thing is true for us. Everything we contribute, everything that we do in the service of Hashem, in the service of making ourselves into greater Jewish people, everything is loved and appreciated and used and is beloved and treasured for eternity by God.
Is this kind of a partnership? Tikkun Olam, to partner with God, and we're in it.
We have to want it. And yeah. The Tikkun Olam, the first Olam that we're supposed to fix, is us. We would like to fix everybody else and everything else. That's sometimes easier. We're supposed to fix ourselves. Like, I am building myself, and that's not considered self-centered. That means building myself does fix the world. That's where it starts, is charity begins at home, and it begins first with me. And we are partners in it. But mostly it was like that God wanted, like, show me you want to be in the relationship, and then we'll have a relationship. So it's like we can't even match. God's love for us, we can't even match that, because God's love for us is completely unconditional. But we're supposed to do as much as we can, which is to want it. And as much as we want it, says that's what built the Mishkan. Because as a structure, it was beautiful, but it wasn't the most amazing thing ever. But it was built out of the love of the Jewish people, and so it was beloved. And so too, each of our actions is every blessing, every prayer, every act of chesed, every amount of tzedakah given with a full heart, every kind word spoken, every act, every word of gossip not spoken, every act of patience, all of those things are our donations. That's where we're building the Mishkan Me'at, the small Mishkan. It says, that's us. We're the Mishkan Me'at. We're building ourselves. So there was a story, and this was shared by Shira Smiles, about a man who, I don't know, lived in New York, and this is a true story. He got a knock on the door one night from one of the people who always comes around, like a mashulach looking person, a collector, someone like, you know, with a hat and a long coat and, you know, payas and a briefcase. And he's says, you know, just a minute, I'll get you some money. He says, no, I didn't come for any money. He's like, you didn't? He said, no, he said, I came to thank you. And he's like, for what? He said, well, you know, can I come in? I want to tell you a story. So he said, sure, so come on in. So what's the story? He said, I have to tell you about, there was a teenage boy about 30 years ago who was college, he wasn't sure what to do. Should he go to college? And he was just kind of aimless. He'd lost his direction, his focus. He was just sitting in the park feeding pigeons. And as she said, you know, it was an old, long time ago that people sat in the park feeding pigeons, and now someone would just be on their iPhone or iPad, not, you know, whatever. So he was sitting in the park, and he happened to see that there was a group of young boys who were playing baseball, and it was, they were religious boys, and it was like the ninth inning, and he started watching the game and saw that it was really, you know, had heated up, and it was very close, and I don't know, it was tied, and second base, third base, and whatever, it was very tight. And then he sees one of the boys run off the field and come past him, and he stops him. He says, how come you're leaving the game? And he said, well, it's almost time for mincha, and I'm wearing shorts. I need to go change and put on long pants to daven. So he's like, he says, and you, that's more, he was like, wow. So the little boy ran off. So this guy, who was kind of aimless, he thought, wow, if there's an 11-year-old boy who's in the heat of a baseball game, like I'm like riveted, I'm not even in the game, and he thinks that there's something more important than the game, that he's going home to change, so that he can daven mincha, maybe I should like check into like Judaism and see, like, there must be more to this than I think there is. Says that he went to like one of these outreach yeshiva things and just thought we'd check it out. Decided to take a class, started taking classes. He said, and he stayed there, and he just stayed there. He became one of Gatzmicha, became one of the rabbis there, and became the Rosh Yeshiva, and that was him at the door. He said, I'm the Rosh Yeshiva, the school has built, I have, you know, whatever, 6 children, it's grown, we've had hundreds of people come in, and I kept your address, I followed you, and I know who you are, and I've been following you, and you were that 11-year-old boy who told me that you were going to go change your shorts into pants so that you could go daven mincha. And I want to thank you, because of that one thing, I became what I am today, and I didn't come for any money, I just came to say thank you. Says, did that 11-year-old boy even think he was doing anything? It's like, he's doing nothing. He's just like going about his business. Says, we don't know the impact of what we're doing, who sees what we're doing, who's influencing, and even if no one sees, that it all gets used. Says, even when there is the smallest donation, it is all kept forever. And it may have an impact centuries later, a generation later, within 30 years, in your own child, a relative, who knows. Even, it says, tears that are shed in prayer for somebody, or for a desire for, you want someone to have a closer relationship, you want to have a closer relationship, all of that is kept and it is stored up. It says that God willing, we set our sights really, really high, and we become wise-hearted people. Those Jewish people, we've said this before, that we understand that we are getting close to the end of times now, of the 6,000-year plan that God has for human history, and that the Jewish people of today are a reincarnation of the generation that left Egypt. And that we can all be chachmat lev, that we can all be wise-hearted, that we can set our sights super high, aim for the best, and work day by day, situation by situation. And what could be a more inspiring life than to know that each step I take is beloved and precious, and it is, like Beth Ann's question, how do I know if I'm making progress? Each step along the way counts. It's not, again, like in our the regular world, where I only am interested when I see your results at the end of the day. It's like, it's the process. It's like, what went into the process? Did you try? What were you aiming for as you did this? So someone who's aiming high and taking a small step is a qualitatively different person than the person who's taking the same step with no aspiration whatsoever. It's a completely different thing. So this is our goal, and as we look at the model of building the Mishkan, that for now, this Mishkan is never going to, it was in existence for a very short time. It's never being built again. We said at the beginning, why are so many parshas devoted to the building of the Mishkan if it wasn't for the fact that we are the Mishkan that we are building? And everything that we are, the Betzalel, which means in the shadow of God, Betzalem Elohim, that we are in the image of God, just like Betzalel, and we have been appointed, God has called us to service, to build and be in charge of the Mishkan of our lives. And God willing, we'll achieve day by day, item by item, situation by situation, and can reach the greatest heights possible, and that we will all be rewarded for the goal that we set for ourselves.
Betzalel's name is related to?
It means in the shadow of God, Betzalem Elohim, in the image of God. Mm-hmm. In the image of God, and that's who, how Betzalel. Betzalel. Yeah, Betzalem.
Did you ever hear anything about him later?
No. I should say I haven't heard anything about him. There's maybe other things about him, but not that I know of. And he was Miriam's great-grandson? Or grandson?
Grandson.
Because Miriam was married to Hur. Is that right, Miriam? No, Hur is Miriam's son. It's her great-grandson, I believe. Someone can check that on Google Docs, whatever. Okay. May we all be privileged to build ourselves into the most precious, beautiful Mishkan, Me'at, day by day, and enjoy the full reward and pleasure, and may we even have the privilege of knowing what the benefits are and what the ramifications are of all of our small acts. And if a small act of an 11-year-old boy can really change history, who knows what all the things that we are doing with consciousness of what those things can yield in the future. Have a wonderful, wonderful Shabbos.